Education derives from the Latin verb educo, which means literally to lead forth, the implication being that it was the role of the teacher to extract what was innately present in the child, an interesting educational theory. The most common Greek verb was paiduo, whose root word is pais, meaning child, the implication here being that the goal of education is to relieve children of their childishness. I'm going to focus on education in the Roman world since this was largely based on the Greek model. But before I do so, I'll need to say something about the Greek model in its original context. Each polis had its own system of education. Athenian education was very different from Spartan. In Athens, it was essentially the father's responsibility to ensure that his offspring received a proper upbringing. If he failed to do so, the child was freed from the obligation of supporting his father in old age. We know very little about Athenian teachers, but they seem to have been poorly paid and had little status. There were no buildings that were specially designed for the purposes of either primary or secondary education. Tertiary education, however, sometimes took place in rooms attached to a gymnasium where athletes trained, hence the word gymnasium, which is used in, to this day, of German high schools. Plato's Academy, for instance, which was named after an Athenian hero called Academus, was located in a gymnasium on the outskirts of Athens. Education for Athenian boys generally lasted from ages 7 to 14. The Greek curriculum consisted of three parts. Number one, learning to read and write and committing to heart the works of the poets, Homer especially. Number two, learning to play the lyre or kithara, an instrument rather like the harp. And number three, physical education. The other educational system that we know about in some detail is the Spartan one. Sparta had sunk into insignificance long before the Romans appeared on the scene, and very likely her educational system had sunk with her. It certainly didn't have any influence on the Romans, but it's fascinating in its own right. At about the age of seven, Spartan boys were removed from their homes and introduced into a public educational system called the agoge, meaning a leading forth, somewhat similar, in other words, to the Roman verb educo. The underlying objective of the agoge was to produce basically a thug, the one whose thuggery was placed at the service of the state. Though Spartan children did learn writing, dancing, and music between the ages of 7 to 12, even at this tender age, they were subjected to harsh punishments if they failed to develop the right attitude. Discipline, in other words, was the overriding objective of their education. When they reached the age of 11, they acquired an older lover known as an Erastes. Scholars are undecided as to whether there was anything sexual in the relationship, but on balance, it seems quite likely that the younger boy had to submit to anal intercourse from his older partner as a form of initiation. Elizabeth Rawson characterized Spartan society as follows: a militaristic and totalitarian state holding down an enslaved population by terror and violence, educating the young by a system incorporating all the worst features of an English public school. It would, of course, be a gross exaggeration to suppose that all Spartans were just militaristic brutes, though there's little to suggest that they were attuned to the finer things of life. We should also note, however, that Spartan girls received some formal education, though the details are obscure. Elsewhere in the Greek world, girls generally did not, though there is some evidence to suggest that there may have been a few exceptions. The poetess Sappho, for instance, is thought to have been associated with a school for young women that flourished on the island of Lesbos in the 7th century BC. In addition, an Athenian red figure vase dated 440 BC depicts a seated woman reading a scroll, sometimes identified as Sappho, and a standing woman holds a lyre. We also hear of women being admitted to philosophical schools, and notably the ones associated with Pythagoras and Epicurus. We may note that there were several Greek communities besides Sparta that provided citizen children with state-sponsored education, particularly in the Hellenistic world. For instance, both the city of Teos, which lies to the north of Ephesus, just off the Turkish coast, and the island of Rhodes legislated that free boys were to receive elementary education. So, to the subject of Roman education. Such limited evidence as we have suggests that in early Rome, parents did most of the teaching and that their main objective was to inculcate a sense of tradition. We gain some impression of this type of education from Plutarch's Life of Cato. Plutarch tells us that Cato the Elder took his son under his own charge and taught him to read, hunt, ride a horse, box, fight in armour, and swim. He also wrote his history of Rome, the Origines, primarily for the edification of his son. Cato's taking responsibility in this way was a reaction to the fact that from the 270s BC onwards, Greek prisoners of war were arriving in large numbers and being better educated than their Roman masters were being employed to teach. As we've seen, one of the first of these educated teaching slaves was the poet Livius Andronicus. Hardly surprisingly, therefore, once the Greeks took over, the Roman educational system came to be based on the Greek model, which meant in turn that the Romans acquired a deep appreciation for Greek language and literature. Probably a few Latin works were studied in this period, such as Ennius's Annales, but they were overshadowed by Greek works, the poems of Homer and the plays of the tragedians in particular. Education, in short, was a not-so-secret Greek weapon. It was the means by which Romans, from childhood onwards, became habituated to the incomparable richness of Greek culture. Remember that great line of Horace, "Greece the captive made her savage victor captive." Anthropologists call this phenomenon reverse acculturation. It is much to the credit of the Romans that they felt sufficiently secure, culturally speaking, to employ Greeks as the educators of choice. We should note, however, that it also had something to do with the contempt which the Romans evinced for professions suited to intellectuals. Another reason for the favouring of Greeks as teachers had to do with their high regard for Greek literature, though that, of course, is something of a chicken-and-egg argument. If they hadn't employed Greek teachers, they wouldn't have come to acquire such a high regard in the first place. Roman children began their formal education at age 7 with simple exercises in reading and writing. School began at dawn, ended in the afternoon. A primary teacher was referred to as ludi magister, literally schoolmaster, and as we saw previously, ludus meant both school and play, which of course is what learning is. We're not working here, you and I, we're playing. That was the Roman concept and the Greek concept as well. It's true. It may be serious play, but it's play nonetheless, in the sense that it's fun. Although, and this is important to stress, there's plenty of evidence to suggest that both the Greeks and the Romans administered corporal punishment to both backward and unruly pupils. Around the age of 12, Roman boys would reach the secondary level, as we'd call it, though in the Roman system the divisions were more informal. The secondary teacher was called a grammaticus, a teacher of language and literature. And under the grammaticus, Romans learned Greek and studied Greek literature, chiefly poetry, though, as we noted earlier, there's evidence to indicate that some children learned Greek as early as they started to learn Latin. If parents were wealthy enough to have their sons stay on past the age of 12, they continued to do more of the same. Translation exercises from the Greek into Latin was a particularly popular school exercise. From the late 1st century onwards, however, we can detect an important change in Roman educational practice, in that more Roman authors began to be studied in school, including the historians such as Sallust and Livy, orators such as Cicero, and poets such as Terence, Horace, and Virgil. Virgil, even in his lifetime, became the Latin poet who was studied most. The greater emphasis that was placed upon Latin literature around the turn of the Christian era demonstrates an important coming of age, if you'll pardon the phrase, for the Romans in relation to their cultural heritage, which they now, regarded justly, no longer inferior to that of the Greeks. And Roman teachers, too, began to make their mark on the profession. One of the most famous was Lucius Orbilius Pupillus, a former soldier who began teaching at age 50. Pupillus, our word, pupil, means someone under the care of a guardian. Perhaps it was a nickname. One of Orbilius's pupils was Horace, who remembered the savage beatings the crusty old fellow had administered in an attempt to instill the poetry of Livius Andronicus into his pupils' heads. It is, of course, very largely thanks to the Roman educational system that Greek literature has survived at all. And just to take one genre that particularly fascinates me, and which I wrote about in a book entitled Surviving Greek Tragedy, Greek tragedy played a significant part in the training of a Roman orator, largely due to the set-piece debates in which tragedy abounds. This is particularly the case in the plays of Euripides, where one speaker urges one course of action and another urges the very opposite. Antithetically paired speeches were reckoned to provide an invaluable training for lawyers and politicians because of the abundance of rhetorical tricks that they contain. Quintilian, an orator and lawyer, actually said that Euripides stood comparison with any orator who has distinguished himself in the court, either as a prosecutor or as a defense lawyer. Tragedy was thus central to a Roman education, both at the secondary and at the tertiary level. By the late 2nd century AD, 24 tragedies had come to be selected as canonical for study in the classroom. 7 of Aeschylus, 7 of Sophocles, 10 of Euripides. Other plays by Euripides have come down to us, but it was these 24 plays that formed the canon of Greek tragedy. It follows that the works of these three playwrights were serving the educational purposes of the Roman Empire from the 1st century BC until at least AD 529, when Justinian closed down the philosophical schools, though the study of tragedy may have remained in the curriculum long after that. We have no means of telling what percentage of the Roman population received at least some education. Mostly, it would have been limited to the elite, though we occasionally hear of wealthy benefactors who set up schools in their hometowns for the local children. Roman girls, like Greek girls, received little education. Interestingly, however, there is evidence to suggest that some were literate. A wall painting from the House of the Mysteries in Pompeii shows a woman holding a roll as she observes a child who is reading from another roll. The woman seems to be giving the child a reading lesson, so she must be literate. And on another wall painting, a woman holds a quill pen to her mouth in her right hand and a book of wax tablets used for writing upon in her left hand. Literacy is, however, an extremely difficult subject to investigate statistically, both because there are so many variables and because there are so many levels of literacy. Athenian democracy depended upon a high level of functional literacy. In classical Sparta, by contrast, where literacy served little practical purpose, its incidence would have been far lower. William Harris believes that the ability to both read and write, that's to say a much higher level of literacy than functional literacy, reached its peak in the Hellenistic cities, since many of them provided elementary education free. Even so, he estimates that only between 20 to 30% of their populations was literate. Literacy is also likely to have been high in Roman Egypt, largely because it was an extremely bureaucratic society which produced a mass of written documentation, birth certificates, death certificates, so forth. We should also bear in mind that there were numerous slaves who could read and write, which meant that a wealthy Roman would perhaps more commonly dictate and be dictated to than actually read and write himself. Before I go on to talk about tertiary education, a few words about the oddity of the Roman curriculum. There seems to have been little formal education in what we would call quantitative literacy. Even something as basic as arithmetic does not seem to have received much attention. History and geography weren't central. Science wasn't either. Music and athletics weren't. though they featured prominently in the Greek curriculum. Plutarch, in an essay entitled On the Education of Children, says that freeborn children should acquire some knowledge of education in general. The term is encuclia paidumata. Encuclia gives us our word encyclopedic, but he goes on to say they should learn it only to get a taste for it. Talking of general education, the so-called liberal arts, or artes liberales, arts deemed worthy of a freeman, were first identified in the Hellenistic period. They included grammar, dialectic, rhetoric, and geometry, arithmetic, astronomy, and music. The 1st century BC polymath Varro added medicine and architecture. The concept of the liberal arts was to play a major part in education in the Middle Ages and beyond. My own university, like many others, continues to debate the aims and ideals of a liberal arts education. Higher or tertiary education began around the age of 16. The principal subjects were rhetoric and philosophy. Both in Greece and in Rome, the ability to speak in public was the hallmark of a well-educated gentleman. The expression, to give a speech, carries a rather negative connotation today. The Greeks, and to a lesser extent the Romans, had, by contrast, an inordinate appetite for long-winded addresses that lasted several hours. Virtually the only contemporary exponents of this art, former communist leaders, though I don't think we should crow too loudly. The ability to speak at length with cogency and forcefulness is a valuable attribute in many walks of life, including my own. In classical Greece, rhetoric was a necessary and vital attribute for anyone who wished to make a mark for himself in a democratic society such as Athens, whether in the political assembly or in the law courts. We should note that jury courts in Athens were typically very large, sometimes as many as 601 jurors, so they provided a forum in which defendants and prosecutors could showcase their skills to the max. Rhetorical skill was first taught by the so-called sophists around the middle of the 5th century BC, although its importance is already evident in Homer, where the ability to persuade in public is a prized asset. The sophists were roundly condemned by Socrates, who regarded their training as antithetical to the pursuit of philosophy. Aristophanes mocked sophists in his play The Clouds, mischievously transforming Socrates into the quintessential sophist who teaches his pupils to be able to argue that black is white. The hostility between practitioners of rhetoric and philosophy would remain a constant throughout antiquity. Plato is particularly dismissive of sophists in his dialogue, The Gorgias, which takes its name from one of its most famous practitioners. In the 4th century BC, schools of rhetoric began to emerge in the Greek-speaking world, such as the one run by an Athenian called Isocrates. The most accomplished rhetorician was Demosthenes, who provided a model for Cicero. Aristotle instructed his pupils in rhetoric as well as philosophy, and he wrote a highly influential treatise on rhetoric. When the Greek states lost their independence, rhetoric ceased to have any political importance, but it still remained the centerpiece of higher education. In the Roman Republic, rhetoric was equally important both in the political and legal arena. Consistent with the Greek tradition, there were two types of rhetorical exercises, which teachers of rhetoric required of their pupils. First, there were the suasorii, which explored dilemmas faced by mythological and historical characters. An example might be an argument put forward by Hannibal explaining why he failed to make an assault on Rome after defeating the Romans at Cannae. And second, there were the controversii, arguments put into the mouth of an advocate on one side of a complicated legal issue. In 93 BC, Lucius Plotius Gallus set up the first school of rhetoric in Rome that conducted its classes in Latin, but the Senate closed it the following year. Possibly it feared that rhetorical training would produce an excess of demagogues capable of challenging the political and social status quo. The tide, however, was irreversible. Less than a decade later, the earliest surviving Roman treatise on rhetoric appeared, an anonymous work entitled Rhetoric to Herennius, 85 BC, once thought to be the work of Cicero. The treatise observes the Hellenistic division of rhetoric into five categories: invention, arrangement, delivery, memory, and style. Cicero's On Invention, which appeared soon afterwards, was also greatly indebted to Greek techniques. Cicero was, in fact, the greatest orator that the Roman world produced, and he knew it. His rhetorical theories were laid out in two handbooks, On Oratory, which celebrated the orator who was capable of speaking on any subject, and The Orator, in which he compared himself unblushingly to Demosthenes. Among his most accomplished speeches were his Philippics, delivered as an attack on Mark Antony in 44 BC, which take their name from the speeches which Demosthenes, his great master, delivered against Philip II of Macedon. Cicero's handbooks signaled the moment when rhetorical instruction began to be conducted for the first time in Latin rather than in Greek. And by the end of the first century, many teachers of rhetoric were themselves Romans, the same development, in other words, that we noted in respect to secondary education. Paradoxically, however, the Philippics were the last rhetorical exercise written with the intention of having political consequence. During the ensuing imperial era, rhetoric lost much of its practical application, since power was chiefly invested in the princeps. So, the only arena in which it retained any overtly practical importance was the law courts. Even so, it remained an important literary vehicle and was used to good effect by the church fathers, including St. Augustine. There was also a tradition in the writing of panegyrics, which continued as late as the 4th century AD. In addition, famous rhetors gave public displays of their debating skills. Imagine today going to a large lecture hall to hear a public debate between two prize concert orators, as they're aptly called, on, say, the topic as to whether death is preferable to dishonour. Thousands did, however, and throughout the empire. The other area of tertiary education was philosophy. Philosophy first made its mark in the education of elite Romans around the middle of the 2nd century BC. In 155, as we've seen, the chief philosophical schools in Athens sent a delegation to Rome to advance the cause of teaching philosophy. In so doing, they were, in effect, engaging in a long-standing quarrel between rhetoric and philosophy, the origins of which, as we've seen, go back to the days of Socrates. The argument that the philosophers advanced was pedagogical. They maintained that it was philosophy that inculcated the ability to present a cogent moral argument. Their motives, however, were self-interested. They realized that there was a lot of money to be made from jumping onto the higher educational bandwagon at a time when Romans were becoming more and more Hellenized. It was not, however, a struggle to the death. To be sure, rhetoric continued to be more popular, largely because it appealed more to the practical bent of the Romans, but philosophy had its devoted adherents as well. And in AD 71, Vespasian established the first state salaried professorships in philosophy and rhetoric in both Athens and Rome, recognizing their equal importance. Even so, there were no philosophical schools in Rome until the 3rd century CE, when Plotinus, the founder of the philosophical movement called Neoplatonism, established one in 244. From the 1st century BC, upper-class Romans had been studying in centres such as Athens and Rhodes, rather as graduate students today go abroad to continue their postgraduate studies, particularly if there's a noted professor they want to engage as their supervisor. We're talking, of course, about a very small minority, but a minority that possessed wealth and power. In the same way, distinguished Greek teachers came to Rome to give lectures. And all this surely helped to build goodwill between the two peoples, as well as provide an opportunity for leading Greek thinkers to shape the perceptions of the next generation of leaders. Finally, I'd like to say a bit about educational theory. This features in several of Plato's dialogues, including the Protagoras and the Meno, as well as the Republic and the Laws. The reason for this is partly because Plato was preoccupied philosophically with the question, can virtue be taught? Plato notoriously banned poetry from his ideal state in the Republic on the grounds that it appealed to the irrational side of human nature and therefore encouraged ill discipline. It's noteworthy, too, that he believed in the educative value of punishment. In the Laws, he writes, "Of all wild creatures, a boy is the most difficult to keep in check, due to the fact that he more than any other of them has a well of intelligence inside him, which is uncurbed. He is a crafty, mischievous, and insolent creature." Which means, he goes on to say, that he has to be regularly chastised, and not just the boy, but also his teacher, by any free person in whose presence he commits a fault. Education is also the subject of a treatise by Plutarch. As we've seen, and though Plutarch was a Greek, he lectured and taught in Rome, so we should think of his views as having influence on the Romans. Learning, says Plutarch, of all enterprises is alone immortal and divine. And he continues, "The two chief things in human nature are mind and reason. The mind exercises control over reason, and it alone comes to maturity with increase of years. And the lapse of time, which strips away everything else, adds understanding to old age." Well, what a great statement. It could be blazoned above the door of the teaching company. I also like his definition of the purpose of philosophy, namely, to teach the young to reverence the gods, to honour one's parents, to respect one's elders, to obey the laws, to show deference to those in authority, to love one's friends, to be proper in one's dealings with women, to be affectionate with children, and not be abusive towards slaves. In conclusion, if you knew nothing about the Romans, you'd hardly work out from their educational system that they were a highly practical people, because there was nothing particularly practical in the Roman curriculum. Nothing, moreover, demonstrates more conclusively the deference that the Romans paid to Greek culture than the fact that they were prepared, initially at least, to leave their children's education largely in the hands of the Greeks. And in assigning this key role predominantly to foreigners, the Romans promoted a type of diversity in the curriculum that is very much in vogue in educational establishments today. Though, and this is very important, by the end of the 1st century BC, Roman literature had come to claim an equal status in the classroom. It was also Rome's accomplishment to establish schools throughout the empire and thus, in the words of Cecil Wootton, complete the historic mission begun by Alexander the Great to spread Greek culture throughout the Mediterranean world. In the next lecture, we're going to focus on a topic that we've already touched on here, philosophy. We're going to see how Greek philosophy came to shape the consciousness of the Roman elite, including generals, politicians, and even emperors. And in so doing, it influenced not only how the Romans saw their world, but also how they sought to understand their place within it.